Sandra, and Noah.
Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Theater World Podcast. We're back.
We're back.
My name is Noah Bender.
And I'm Sandra Nemchik.
And with us this week is one of the most in-demand young directors in the business right now. She recently directed the Kennedy Center hit production of Sunset Boulevard, starring Stephanie J. Block. The feature documentary, The Show Must Go On, about the global and Korean theater communities returning from COVID, and has recently opened a new Broadway-bound interpretation of Evita at Massachusetts American Repertory Theater. Please welcome Sammy Canold.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you for having us.
We're glad to have you. You're zooming in from Mexico. You're on vacation. You're just kicking back. Are you like in between things right now?
Yeah, I'm. I don't have rehearsal this week, so I, had a lot that I had to do virtually. But my fiance and I just sort of decided that it was a good idea to get out of New York, and we're not too good at vacation. But we were like, okay,
You'd do more work if you were actually at home.
Yes. So it is a bit of a break, which is really nice. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, it seemed like you had a whirlwind year so far with these two very high-profile revivals.
It was intense. Yeah. But I'm in a lucky way. It's sort of like every day you're like, oh my gosh, I'm so tired. And also I'm so lucky. So you sort of have to balance those two things.
Totally. You're almost like Evita, like getting the fame like Evita. Obviously not exactly like Evita, but your fame is growing pretty rapidly. Like it's crazy how in demand you are right now.
Thank you. That's very kind. And I feel very lucky to get to do what I love to do, and to particularly to get to like tell the stories that I want to tell. That mm-hmm. I feel like is a rare gift. I'm grateful.
Well, I mean, let's talk about Evita, because you seem to have such a strong connection with that show. This is what, your third time doing Evita? What's your connection to that piece so much?
Yeah, so I first saw Evita when I was a teenager. I saw the Broadway revival, and I was so knocked out by the story and by the music, and I knew some of the music beforehand. I feel like everybody knows Don't Cry for Me, Argentina, and sort of a lot of the hits.
Oh, yeah.
But I didn't really know the story until I saw the show, and after I saw the show, I was immediately so unbelievably obsessed. And I read every book I could find on Eva Perón. And then when I was in college, I got a grant to go to Argentina to do research and learn more about her, and ultimately directed a production of Evita for my thesis in college. That sort of set off this many, many year journey with mm-hmm. with the show. And then, you know, as you said, I was very lucky to get to do it again in 2019 at New York City Center, which in a way our team sort of thinks a little bit about as two productions, because we did a pre-pro production with a group of Pace students who were really incredible. And then we did the production itself at City Center. And then now we're doing it at ART, and we'll do it again at STC in September.
Is it just like mostly scaling up the kind of same production?
Yes and no. So the production that I directed in college is very different aesthetically from what we did at City Center.
Probably a smaller budget too.
Yeah.
Paper.
Yeah. But there are some elements of the ART STC production that actually are exactly the same as they were when I was in college, which feels very sort of beautiful and full circle in some sort of way. We have our Art of the Possible is staged exactly as it was when I was in college, and then a few other sort of smaller elements. But the City Center production is very similar in feel to the ART STC production. That is, you know, what you were saying, we've just scaled it up quite a bit. So there's now a lot of automation. There's a elevator and a lift in the floor. Mm-hmm. We have much longer to put it together. At City Center, one of the hallmarks of those productions is that you put them together in 10 days. So they're sort of concert staging-esque. And now this is really a full production. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, we've just been really interrogating and playing with the way that we present certain characters and stage different numbers. And so I'd say about 60% of the staging is completely different from City Center, just because we've discovered new ways of telling different stories. The character of Che has changed a lot. Different things like that sort of make it a new production. So I talked to some people who are like, oh, I saw City Center, I already saw it. And I'm like, no, yeah. You didn't see it.
Like, so like prelude. When you are like directing, like, do you have like little like ketchup bottles that you're moving around like on like a table, or like what is your, how do you envision like go from taking it into your brain to like putting it on stage?
Yeah, sometimes I use little figurines. I have little Tabasco bottles, so similar to
oh, really?
There you go.
Yeah, actually, I have like a bag of 30 miniature Tabasco bottles. Cute. That I use a lot. So there's that, but then I also have these little sort of alien figurines, like the aliens from Toy Story. Those I use sometimes, and then sometimes, you know, it's a pencil and paper and just drawing charts and. Of course, that sort of dovetails with the work that our choreography team is doing, and sort of mm-hmm. we do a bit of a handoff. And on Avita, we also have a intimacy director, so that's sort of a another level of collaboration that gets added to the way that things are staged. But I'm a very prep oriented director. I don't like going into the room without a sense of what the number is going to be. And of course that can change a million times. And in fact, on Avita, it did change a million times. This mm-hmm. cast was so game and flexible because we would put up a version of a number and say, nah, we can do better. And then we try again with mm-hmm. something completely different. Yeah. And they were really game for that. So I'm grateful.
Yeah. One of my old choreographers used to block numbers with Skittles.
Ah, wow. That's yeah. really interesting, because I would imagine they're a little hard to pick up. But
I think it's with the color coding of everything.
Okay. You just kind of slide it around. Yeah, maybe that's lines nice. Or something.
So Evita is, you know, a historical piece. It involves a true story of a real person whose legacy has kind of been amplified and shaped through this musical in many ways. Like, what do you think the, like, role of, like, telling true stories of and history on stage, you know, can be?
I feel a great responsibility, particularly with this story, to really understand the history behind it and the impact behind that history, particularly in Argentina today. It's why I personally have gone to Argentina four times now to do research to prepare for these productions. And I think that it's a balance of understanding that you're depicting something in art. One person's life can't be summed up in every single detail in the right. span of 2.5 hours. Right. But at the same time, you do have the weight and responsibility of telling the story of a person who actually lived. And so I think that in many cases, because, you know, as a director, I'm telling a story that was put on paper, you know, decades ago, I have the responsibility of thinking about what does it mean to tell this story specifically now? Right. And what do we know now that we might, you know, that might not have been known decades ago? And, you know, and all that being said, I, you know, in the many, many weeks that I've spent cumulatively in Argentina and the, you know, months and years I've spent researching after that, my take is that sort of the musical itself is incredibly well researched. I'm very dumbfounded by the fact that like the writers managed to get as much information as they did into the piece at a time when like the internet didn't exist. And you know, it really stands the test of time. And we understand that there are things that are sort of like foggy in history. For example, like historians don't even know what the Magaldi encounter was or was not. And so I think that's a moment where sort of artistically you can say, okay, in a piece of theater, we're gonna, you know, tell a version of what we think might have happened. And regardless of whether or not it did happen, it does resemble a number of things that we know did happen. And so it, to me, it's about sort of what is the impact of what you're saying? And I think a lot about that when I direct.
Yeah. And Eva Perón, like, she did a lot of questionable things. So in your version, are you trying to make her as likable as possible? Like this, like, politician that has this big aura about them. And then, or are you trying to show another side to this person where it's kind of a little conniving, a little evil?
In my mind, it doesn't have to be an either or, like both things can be true. And that's really what this production sort of, one of the things this production aims to do is to show the duplicity of mm-hmm. a single human being and the complexity and the contradictions that might exist within a single human being. Yes, it's true that like many, many, many people thought and think of her as a saint and their lives were positively changed by
I'm sure some still do.
She did. Oh yeah. Oh, completely. Many, many, many people, you know, in Argentina today when you talk to them about it. But you know, on the flip side, many, many, many people feel the opposite way. And, you know, my personal opinion is somewhere in the middle of those two groups. And I think that one of the things that I'm really passionate about is showing who she was as a human, because I think that a lot of the time we get a lot of information about, you know, the things that she did and the things that, like, you know, her actions, but not necessarily who she was, what her childhood was like, what she was feeling in a given moment. And mm-hmm. so that's something that I'm really interested in and excited about. But yes, embracing all of the above and not really picking a lane.
Because yes, yeah. So much of that show is about how the masses' characterization of one individual can get so much out of hand and out of that person's control, and how, you know, she starts to mean so much more to certain people than she can really understand.
Exactly, and I think it's regardless of, you know, even if she was sort of purely an angel, did absolutely nothing wrong, the fanaticism is a bit scary, I think. It's great for people to adore and be grateful to their leaders, but then it can go a little too far.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that, you know, what the goal of our production is not to make you walk out and think, oh my God, wow, she was amazing. I should build a shrine to her in my room. Or, you know, oh my God, what an awful woman. You know, I'm going to go make a voodoo doll. It's to say, I went on a journey with someone that I connected to on a human level. And then when she started to do bad things, I felt a little bit conflicted about it. And mm-hmm. That is the complexity and push and pull of getting to tell stories. And it's something that I think so often people are trying to put this musical in a box in terms of, you know, is she good or is she bad? And I just don't think it's that simple.
Maybe we should move to another complex person. Sure. Norma Desmond, what was it like working with Stephanie J. Block? One of my like personal like heroes, like I've been a fan of hers forever, but like, what was it like? I mean, I'm sure she's as wonderful as ever, right?
She's just incredible. I mean, like just such an amazing artist, which I think everybody knows from seeing her work on stage. But I feel like the gift that I got in that process was getting to understand what an incredible artist and collaborator she is in the room. I was a bit nervous going into that process, to be honest, because most of the time that I've directed musicals, I've been working with folks who are at a similar experience level to me. And so it feels like we can, you know, I'm not intimidated by them necessarily, or you know, we can go on the journey together. In the case, and that's not always true, but that's sort of been
just
true.
Kind of like jumping in the deep end.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, with Stephanie, it was just sort of like, my God, like, you know, I grew up seeing her in shows and she's so Broadway legendary I think also it's just sort of she's such a Broadway baby through and through that to come into a room and say, okay, please trust me because we're going to very quickly stage the show was a very sort of daunting thing. And it could have gone so many other ways. And I just feel so lucky that she and Derek Klena and everybody in that company was just ready to embrace and trust and follow. And I think that, you know, with her in particular, that's just a big gift because she didn't have to do that. So it really felt like a very fruitful, exciting, you know, beautiful collaboration that I'm really, really grateful for.
How many months did you have, or how much time did you have?
Oh, we had 11 days.
Oh,
wow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was, yeah.
There's so much to chew on in that time.
The Kennedy Center processes are like encores.
Okay, yeah. So it was more kind of like a stage reading, but more with choreography and blocking and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, they unlike encores, they don't call them staged concerts, but the timing is similar, and sort of the resources are similar in the sense that you're putting the orchestra on stage. It's a very fast, you know, rehearsal process. You can't really, the goal is not to, you know, make sets with automation or things like that. It's sort of and the run itself is only, I think, 10 performances. So it's sort of a they wouldn't call
it. Yeah, I know people were clamoring for more.
A stage concert, but I think they would call it sort of like a minimalist take on
Well, it seemed like your and Stephanie's mutual goal was to kind of reshape the narrative around who Norma Desmond is, because I feel like in so many other stagings of this musical, she's kind of this tragic figure, kooky, helpless, delusional, and from everything I heard and read, it felt like the goal was to, you know, bring more agency and control into her character, where she kind of knows exactly what she's doing, but doesn't have the power or resources to make her voice heard all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. That was definitely the goal. And I think that it came from an impulse of saying, oh, you know, there's this woman at the center of the story. And I just really wonder, like, how did she end up like this, you know?
Right.
What were the sort of systemic factors that drove her to become this? And, you know, we did something in where we had, you know, a number of specific moments where we sort of explored this, but in particular, there was a little flashback scene where we showed sort of a younger version of her and what she went through that kind of led her to become the way she became. In addition to that, we did have, it's funny because the dialogue around that production, because the process was so fast, sort of came very very quickly. And then so originally there was a conceit where we were going to put the show within a framing device where Betty was the storyteller. And we staged it, and we did it in rehearsal. We were really excited about it. We got permission to do it. The idea was basically that Betty had, at the end of the story, written a script or a screenplay called Sunset Boulevard, and the story was hers, and her story opened with Joe
kinda
coming
like
out
cabaret.
And
saying,
centering on Joe.
Yeah,
and that was sort of meant to sort of explain why
more power
we
to
were
women.
Making a number of choices that exactly, you know, without being like rah-rah feminist, but that was sort of the goal. And then what ended up happening was we had one day of tech, and when we teched that moment, it just wasn't quite working. And I think that, you know, in a longer process, I'd be excited to sort of, you know, play with that idea more. It just was sort of in that moment, the right decision was to cut it. I was really excited by the ideas that we were exploring.
Maybe you'll direct it again and then just rework it in there.
Exactly. Who knows?
Who knows?
'Cause yeah, I could see it being framed as like a dark biopic even.
Mm-hmm.
Where
And I think it was sort of, you know, Betty having gone through this like crazy traumatic experience where she you know, meets a guy
trauma
and
dumps.
Then
yeah, because she's equally
then
manipulated and everything.
Joe's really not a great guy, is he?
No. and you know, depending on how likable the actor who plays him is, and with, you know, in the case of Derek, very likable, you really I find myself really, you know, sort of falling for him as a character, and then you really get, you know, it's pretty upsetting when he turns out to be a pretty awful guy.
I have to ask, through all these, you know, big productions plus the work you did with Phantom and Cats in Korea, do you have a relationship with Lord Andrew?
I do. I'm very lucky too, and with Tim Rice as well. They've been very, very supportive, which I think is such a gift to you know, a young theater maker. I think that one of the things that Andrew's company, the Really Useful Group, really in particular embraces and leads with is that they're really open to new interpretations and productions of their work, because they understand that the way that, you know, work lives on from generation generation to generation is being embraced by each generation. And so I'm very lucky to have been the beneficiary of that and to know both of them personally and see them often. And so it's a real gift.
Yeah. What kind of consultation do you have to have with really useful group when you're staging, you know, a large scale production of one of their famous shows?
They're, you know, to some extent, you're sort of given the what's on paper and said, and they say, you know, run with it. And then if you have, you know, questions or requests about, you know, how you want to navigate things, just let us know, you know. So for example, you know, on Evita, we have in the charity concert, we do a tango, there's tango dance at the same time that they're singing Surprisingly Good for You, which is how it was done in the original. And in the original production, there was a line sort of introducing the tango dancers. And so that's an example of a time when I went back to Really Useful and said, hey, you know, I know the revival and subsequent productions haven't done this tango, but I'd like to do it like in the original. Can we restore that line? Because it makes sense in this production. And then they, you know, give a determination. But then in addition to that, you know, once the show is up, they come and give feedback and, you know, I sort of work with them to make the show the best that it can be. In the case of something like Sunset, because it was sort of a short one-off situation, they were there for any questions or, you know, approval requests, but didn't, you know, it wasn't really about getting the show to Broadway or anything.
Is Angela going to see your Evita?
Yes. Yes.
That's awesome. That's pretty cool.
That's cool. Because, yeah, like, I know that he is kind of famously protective of what you can and can't include in, mm-hmm. you know, creative interpretations of his works.
In a way that I deeply understand, and I would be the sure. same way if I wrote a musical. Because it's, you know...
it's his baby.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we're... But I think that they've been very... I think Really Useful has been really amazing just in terms of understanding the you know sort of various requests that we've made, but at the end of the day, you know, my goal as a director is not to change the text of a given revival. Right. It's to say, how can I take the text of a given revival that I adore and through staging add another, you know, layer or my own specific take to it.
Yeah, well, we talked about revivals, let's talk about some new works. You were on the ground floor of Xandra's all-time favorite musical, Great Comet.
Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet, 1812. Yeah. You have to say the full
nice
title,
poster.
Noah. Thank you. It took me years to find it.
Yeah, what was it like developing that show with Rachel Chavkin, who I know is one of your mentors?
It was incredible to be in the orbit of that show. So I came on board when the show was at ART. And by that point, they'd already done the Ars Nova production and the two tent productions. I came on board as the assistant director. When the show moved to Broadway, I think it was 2015, I moved with it and ultimately after it opened, became the associate director and maintained the show. And put in, you know, new people and things like that once it opened. And not only was it just an incredible, thrilling experience, because I similarly just am such a super fan of the show and of Rachel. And so getting to be in her orbit as she was creating that was really, really special. But also, I think it was like the best possible training as a director that I could have asked for, because that show was so directorially complex. Yeah. To understand every element of it and how Rachel crafted it, and then to have to be the one maintaining it, was a real crash course in big, complex, you know, physically demanding musicals. And I think the other thing is, I think about this when I talk to sort of directors who've just graduated and are trying to figure out what their trajectory is. I think that working as an associate or as a resident director is the best possible training you can have, because you have to execute in the sense that you have to communicate staging and give notes and, watch a show on a given night and understand what's not working and what is working. But at the same time, you don't yet have to have your own creative ideas. Right. You're just maintaining someone else's. So for me, having the sort of lack of stress of it being my ideas and my show and my name on the poster, like, but having to do sort of all the actions of being a director was such great training and has, you know, prepared me to be.
Were you able to put your two cents into the show? Like, were there some things that you were like, hey, what if we do this? And she was like, ah, yeah.
You know, it's really interesting. Depending on which director you're an AD for, you have more or less input. And I sort of don't really have a strong feeling about what's better or worse, because sometimes when you do have more input and then you give an idea and it's a bad idea, you feel really good.
You're like, whose idea was that? It's worse.
Yeah. So in the case of Rachel, she was very open and eager for thoughts. I think that because you know, it was actually the beginning of my relationship with her. I ended up working on a number of other shows with her after that. I intentionally kind of hung back in terms of contributing ideas. But I think that where I really got to exercise creative autonomy was in the maintenance process, because, you know, there would be months at a time where she would be working on another project in, you know, in another country. I mean, there was a stretch where she was in London the whole time. And so if decisions needed to be made quickly, I was the one to represent the department. And so it was, you know, and at the time I was 22, so it was very scary.
Yeah.
But I just sort of had to be like, okay,
rehearsal or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's so the sort of the decision of like, you know, you work very closely with the stage management team and the dance captain and things like that. But, you know, there would be shows where like 3-4 people would be out and we'd have to figure out what was the combo of, you know, of things that we put on or understudies that we put on to make a show that is going to be cohesive and coherent. And you usually have like 5 minutes to make those decisions. So it's things like that. Or, you know, after, you know, you have all these, on a Broadway show, you have all these public appearances. So there were like Good Morning America or the Today Show or, you know, the Tony number, things like that, that the associates and the dance captain and stage management are really the ones who kind of spearhead. Usually like the director and choreographer will present like a vision for the overall number, but then it's on you to kind of say, okay, this person's going to stand here, this person's going to stand here. So figuring that out was like a part of the job that I loved and I learned a ton from.
Well, you did a great job in Good Morning America.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a group effort.
I feel like one thing people don't really consider about these, you know, big, huge Broadway shows is that there's so much maintenance and work to be done once it's in its finalized form and up and running. Like the directors and the creatives, you know, are able to shape it, but once it is up and running, there's so much to maintain. Can you talk about what it's like maintaining the understudies and swings and
making sure they're tight?
Yeah, that area of the working production.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's sort of, we think of this, as you were saying, like run up to opening night and it's like opening night and you did it. And on Broadway, that's just sort of not true because it's just the beginning. And, you know, your show is only as good as any given show.
Right.
So I think that maintenance is really hard because it's a mix between the technicality of the maintenance of like, hey, you know, reminder to point your toe, you know, on this line. And also the sort of spiritual, emotional maintenance of how a given building is functioning. You know, in a way, associates and residents and stage managers have to do a lot of like interpersonal therapy and like group dynamic work, because inevitably what will happen is, you know, one actor is not happy with the way another actor is doing a scene, or one actor is not bringing, you know, the right amount of energy to their track, or, you know, there's so many different things that are sort of elusive that are hard to describe or know that you're responsible for. You know, even in things like, you know, in the girls' dressing room, someone is, you know, eating very smelly food, right? Like, you know, yeah. just like things like
so
that.
So director and therapist and problem solver.
In your purview.
All of the above.
So, you know, things like that, that you just sort of have to, that sometimes you look at yourself and you say, I didn't go to college for this.
but now you're a parent to a whole bunch of people.
The best way. Exactly. It feels like parenting a lot of the time. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what parenting feels like. I'm not a parent, but I imagine it's what parenting feels like. Yeah.
Yes. Theater is a living organism, as you will.
Yes. Exactly.
A whole bunch of children just needing to be pushed around on stage.
Yes, exactly.
In the same vein as Great Comet, I feel like much of your work involves site-specific theater. You know, you've done a musical on a bus at Ellis Island. Like, how do you approach transforming a space and involving the space when you're prepping a new project?
So, I mean, I think that in the case of site-specific works, to me, it's all about embracing the space and not ignoring the fact that you're in a different space.
Right.
I will always remember when I was working on Ragtime on Ellis Island, we went to the island for the first time and we were meeting the different vendors on the island, because when you work on the island, you can work with different vendors who can give you chairs or they can give you, you know, tablecloths, whatever you need. And I was talking to one of the vendors and they said, oh, you know, we'll put pipe and drape up along this wall to mask the historic wall. We'll put, you know, this to mask this. And I was like, no.
Yeah, why do you
want
to mask that?
The whole goal of this is that we're going to embrace it. And I think that sometimes the thought when you're making something like that is to turn the space into a theater. And to me, it's the opposite. It's to sort of like figure out how to make theater authentically in the space. And so what that brings with it is like a ton of complexity in terms of the logistics. Like, you know, a place like Ellis Island or something like a bus, you know, you have to reinvent the wheel in terms of how things are done, right? Because, you know, Ellis Island doesn't have dressing rooms, you know, buses don't have amplification for singers, you know, it's sort right. of all these things that we don't really think about when we're in a traditional venue. You do have to think about in a venue like that.
That's where improv comes in.
Yes, exactly. Quick decision making in improv.
Yes, and.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I also want to talk about, I read that you even played a role in the early stages of Kimberly Akimbo.
yes.
What was it like, you know, developing that show with, because I know you have a relationship with Janine Tesori as well, and David Lindsay Abaire.
Yeah, that was a very special experience. So basically what happened was, I was working on a production of Violet at the ART, and Janine was aware of it and was mm-hmm. very supportive. And at the time, she and David had just finished Act One of Kimberly Akimbo, this was 7 years ago now. Janine called me and she said, "Look, you know, I have this new musical with David Lindsay Abaire, and we're invited to Sundance in Utah to do a 2-week lab. And we want to bring a young director with us who won't be the eventual director of the show." You know, at the time I was 22 and certainly not qualified to be directing a Broadway musical. But we want someone to come and sort of facilitate the room. We know, you know, sort of what we need to do creatively, but we want someone who can sort of, you know, help with what the presentation is going to look like.
Maybe like a stage manager?
And that type of thing. Yeah, it was kind of like, you know, we had a wonderful stage manager, but it was kind of like mm-hmm. acting as, you know, facilitator more
act
so
manager.
than director. I mean, I was called the director, which was an honor. But what ended up happening was, and it's a kind of sad, funny, scary story, is that we were on our way to Sundance, and Janine had an issue with her brain, where she ended up in the hospital very suddenly and scarily, and she couldn't come to Sundance. And so I'm at the airport with David, and we're very concerned about Janine. And she like delivered a message to us through someone and said, I'm really sorry I can't come for the first week, because her doctor said she couldn't come, but please tell Sammy that she's in charge and she should make things happen. And I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, that's like that the understudy getting called up by surprise.
Christine Daae can do it.
Yeah.
It's you now.
Yeah. I know. And I was like, oh no. And at the time, you know, the cast of that, you know, it wasn't the you know, the current Broadway cast, but it was, you know, Annie Golden was Kimberly, Kayla Settle was in it, Alex Brightman was in it, Kate Weatherhead was in it, Caitlin Kennedy was in it. It was like, you know, this incredible, you know, more folks
all-star
as well.
Cast.
Company, all-star cast. And there I was, you know, 22. And I was like, hi guys, Janine's not here, but I'm in charge.
Let's
like,
work.
Here we go. And, you know, we did an exercise where we just staged all of Act One just so that David and Janine could see it on its feet. And it was really fun. And we did it in a week. We just staged the whole act. Then Janine showed up, which was great. And I was very relieved.
Tag me out.
But
tag
it's,
me
it's
out.
Really, yeah. Yeah. I was like, I'm
you done good, kid.
But, it, you know, it's very full circle to, you know, to see it now. And I've gotten the, you know, privilege of getting to work in rooms, you know, collaborate with Janine since then. And so that was yet another like sort of trial by fire early experience that I think prepared me to, you know, be able to do it to helm my own shows now.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, Janine Tesori is a total trailblazer and, you know, her work is reverberant.
Yeah. It really
you
is.
Know, speaking of like you just being like thrown into things and everything like that, there's just a narrative of you focused on age and how does ageism play into like your, I guess, origin story?
For me personally, I think in an interesting way, like age has helped me more than anything because it's sort of become a bit of a calling card to say, if you want a young woman's take on your material, right, like I'm happy to provide that, whatever that means. I don't mind the narrative so much because I don't think it comes with a question of capability. It just sort of comes with a, oh, that's cool. And then, you know, folks, you know, let me do stuff. I've certainly been in situations where less because of age on paper and more because of the fact that I look very young and because I'm a woman, like where I feel like capability is questioned. And in some cases, that's a little offensive. And in some cases, you know, I don't have the experience that someone 10 years my senior, 20 years my senior would have. So I have many complicated feelings about it, but mostly I don't resent it because I feel very lucky. And the other component of that is that, you know, my parents both work in entertainment. My mom is a theater producer and film director, and my dad is a film producer. And so I think a lot about, you know, Malcolm Gladwell has this 10,000 hour rule, right, where he says that in order to become an expert at anything, you have to, you know, have 10,000 hours of experience. And for me, my 10,000 hours started when I was a baby, really, because I was sitting in Broadway rehearsal rooms,
right,
as a kid. And so that osmosis, you know, like learning our industry is, there's a really big learning curve to not just learning the trade and the craft, but also to learning the etiquette and the politics and certain systems. And so I feel very lucky that I already knew a lot of those by the time I entered the professional world.
Yeah, I feel like getting to do the opportunities that you've gotten to do is kind of worth being labeled a young director.
Yeah, I don't mind it.
Yeah. All right, well, let's move on to our theater world lightning round. I'm gonna ask you some quick fire questions about your tastes, yes, and opinions in theater. Sammy, who is your favorite Broadway diva?
Heather Headley.
Ooh. Ooh. I love Aida.
Oh, me too. Anytime she's on stage, I just feel like, oh, I'm witnessing someone who is not like human. She just feels so.
Well, there's like a lot like, going on. You can see everything behind. Yeah. You know, she's a smart actor.
She's one of the actors who has like 100% control of her instrument.
Mm-hmm. Completely. Completely.
She has intention behind everything.
And it's
so unique
and so special. And like, it's like, I can't really say it, that there's anyone like her. You know, she's like wholly herself.
Yeah. I wish I could have seen her in The Lion King. That would have been amazing.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
All right. Next question. What is your dream role?
As an actor, like if I were an actor?
It could be. Yeah.
Oh. I mean, if I do not, I can't sing. But if like, you know, so I steer clear of being musicals. But if I could, I would want to play Ava Braun. I mean, who wouldn't? It just feels so exhilarating.
Yeah, I mean, she gets just so many capital M moments.
Yeah, and she's on stage the entire show.
Exactly, and 12 costume changes, and you know, and I'm not Latinate, so I would never play her anyway. But you know. In a hypothetical world, I would play it.
Yeah, just a fabulously complex character.
Yes.
Yes.
What is there a show you'd like to revive that you think hasn't been seen recently or in a new way?
Man of La Mancha is the top of my personal.
Okay, I've never seen that show. That's one of my theater blind spots.
It's really incredible, and the score is so beautiful.
What draws you to that show?
I think mostly the score, but also the story is so hopeful and so inspiring and encapsulates so much of the reason that I think so many of us do theater in the first place, that I think it's just like, you know, it's dark and complex, but it also, it the message of it is very, hopeful.
You know, in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, there's a windmill, so maybe you can bring it there, go outside.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Site-specific
limitation.
We're actually just a windmill behind.
What do you think of outdoor theater?
I mean, I love it. It's hard to do, you know, for many sonic and lighting and elements reasons, but I love going to it and I love making it.
Yeah, I just want to say, I recently saw the most amazing outdoor production that was like on the top of a mountain in Los Angeles, like overlooking all of Glendale with like the city and the mountains behind us. It was like at sunset. I saw Pirates of Penzance for the very first time live.
Wow.
Which is one of my favorite shows. But yeah, like it was like this pirate ship at sunset with the mountains behind it. Like, when you have the right venue, for an outdoor show or any kind of, you know, site-specific work, like the surroundings can really elevate the entire experience. Yeah.
I saw Xanadu last year outside it, and they were roller skating on top of a rooftop.
Oh, wow. Oh my gosh, cool. That's amazing.
It was really cool. What song, moment, or show that always makes you cry?
Recently, Parade.
Yeah, there's so many moments in that one.
Yeah. I cried a lot.
What about young Sammy? What would she say?
Oh, probably Les Mis. I just was so like galvanized by it.
There's like 12 cry moments in that show.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And the scene when Eponine dies. Oh my God.
Oh. or when Fantine comes back and she's like, hello.
Yeah. I mean, I admit I'm not somebody who, I mean, I do cry in real life. But I'm not someone who cries in theater a lot. And the only two shows that I've ever actually cried in are Parade and Tuck Everlasting, which is a curveball of an answer. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. That show
Is
a little like cray, like, you know, thinking about like an old man seducing a young little girl. And you're just like, oh.
I think it was like the conversation about mortality that was just like so profound. I, you know, it wasn't that really
with the family,
but yeah. So I don't, I mean, and I feel like sometimes when people cry in theater, it's because like they, whatever they're bringing in from their day, like hits the show at that moment in time. And you know, that sort of leads to certain emotions. And so that might've been sort of me on that day, but like my record is I've only ever cried Tuck Everlasting.
That's interesting because I consider myself someone who doesn't cry that much during real life, but in theater, I'm so much more susceptible to cry when somebody is singing.
Oh, interesting.
Like that. Like when I saw Dear Evan Hansen or Les Mis or trying to think of another like Hades Town. I've actually never seen Miss Saigon, but I definitely when I saw an opera presentation of Madame Butterfly and definitely cried during that. I feel like when things are sung, it brings up those emotions so much easier for me.
Yeah, I think for me, I do wonder if it's a little bit because I think about theater very scientifically in the sense that, you know, I have a friend who said he loved music until he took a music theory class in college. And now every piece of music that he hears, he thinks about it mathematically because he's thinking, oh, that's, you know, that's what that is. That's what that is. And I think about theater that way. When I go to see a show, it's very rare for me to get completely lost in it because I'm thinking about, oh, how
the
much
decisions,
how
it's working.
Yeah. This exactly. Should have been this way. They forgot to do that. Yeah, I saw a show yesterday, and she says, my nails are wet. My nails are wet. Don't touch me. It was Steel Magnolias. But she went like this with her hair, and I was like, no, don't do that. Your nails are wet. You can't touch your hair.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. We're those who make theater. We're all sort of snobby.
Very stickler.
What does it take to kind of drop that lens where you can allow yourself to just enjoy it purely artistically rather than thinking about how you would have done it or just your opinions on how it works? It's a tough dichotomy with that.
I agree.
And the final, most important, lofty question is, can you recall the single greatest experience you've ever had at the theater? This could be in the audience, in the rehearsal room, the single greatest experience.
That is so hard.
I know.
You could do top three, I guess, or top two.
This is not the I'll tell you what came to mind immediately.
Sure, I
wouldn't say
for.
That if I were like, you know, if I were sort of writing it in a book, I would defend this answer. But is I saw Cirque du Soleil's Ka.
Yes.
And my life was like really changed by seeing it because and I would say that similarly about I saw the World Cup opening ceremonies this past year. Like live in person, and both of those experiences, because they weren't sort of traditional theater, but the spectacle was unbelievable, really rocked my world and made me think a lot about the way that we make things.
Yeah, I saw Ka in Las Vegas when I was 7 years old, and that's that show is so mind-blowing. It's so unlike any other kind of presentation. Yeah, can you talk about what you took away from that experience?
Well, I think that just the spectacle is at a whole other level than what we are able to achieve on Broadway, in my opinion. Just in terms of, you know, for many reasons, practical reasons, it's not a comment on the artistry of Broadway folks. It's just sort of a different kind of arena. Yeah, and the financial model is completely different, right? So there's more that's sort of possible, but they have this this stage that not only sort of rotates in the sense that it feels like, you know, the whole stage is on a turntable, but it's on this arm so that it can lift up, and then the stage becomes completely perpendicular to the ground, and
the climbing scene is
climbing up and down
intense.
The stage, and then it rotates, and I think it's just things like that where I'm just like, wow, it's sort of like a theme park of a musical, in a way.
It has everything.
But it just, and I think when I looked at the financials of it, I was like, oh my god, this is crazy. Like the idea that we would ever, you know, be able to sustain something like that on Broadway is unlikely. But it just, it makes me think about, and also the show, literally.
It's
similarly like so spectacular. There's a lot that Cirque does that I think we could learn from in terms of spectacle.
Do you think there's a place for a Cirque-style show on Broadway? Because it kind of feels inevitable that the worlds will marry at some point, or at least adapt to, you know, more of a New York sensibility and the parameters of what you can accomplish in a New York stage.
It's interesting because I've worked with Cirque quite a bit actually, and I've had this conversation with them because they like to bring theater artists into their fold. And, you know, there are a number of Cirque shows that have been directed by theater folk. But I think that the conversation around how much narrative that style of art can hold is like a really interesting one. Because Cirque shows, like their hallmark is that they don't have
more avant-garde stuff.
It's more artistry over just narrative.
Yeah. And so I think that you know, at least in my conversations with them, they were very open to the idea of there being narrative, but it couldn't be told through words, which is the sort of bread and butter of what we do on Broadway. So to me, it's a question of like, can the abstraction of that artistry be married with the storytelling of ours with words? I don't know. It's a really interesting question. And, you know, one that I think a lot of people are thinking about, because there is, you know, crossover between those worlds.
Something that maybe somebody already knows, like Peter Pan, the story of Peter Pan could be something like that, you know, a little less words.
It's a good idea,
It's like adapting a ballet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, right. It's like a ballet.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because, yeah, like I never thought of it like as a rule that there's no, you know, spoken communication in Cirque du Soleil, because there is so much emotion and character communicated, just not through dialogue and scene work. It's all through
some people don't speak English.
Flips
too.
And tricks. Yeah, all and the it also involves a lot of international artists who don't communicate in English to begin with. And so many specialists.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
I mean I guess it seems like the closest thing we got was the Pippin revival, where that involved so many circus elements that hadn't really been explored on a Broadway stage to that scale, with so many specialists and just circus people who are circus people primarily, and then theater artists as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to me, that revival was sort of more, and I was so enthralled by that revival, but I think it was more about sort of exploring the art of circus specifically. Yeah. Whereas to me, what's exciting about Ka is less the circus elements of it and more the fact that the size and scope of the spectacle is just so huge and makes you feel like there, you know, there's something larger than you going on. And so it's more in the world of like, you know, the boxing ring coming out into the audience at Rocky, you know, or the chandelier flying, you know, in Phantom. It's like, what are these moments of spectacle that are sort of based on physical elements that we do have some of in theater, but I think that like the circus world does better. Like, you know, or not the circus world, the Cirque world specifically does better. And I think that the, you know, another thing that I'm super, super obsessed with is, you know, Olympic opening ceremonies, I think, do this really well, mostly in terms of the scale of number of people that they involve, which would never be possible on Broadway, right?
We could
never
do a Broadway show with one thing.
Yeah, it's just not going to happen. But when I watch something like the London 2012 opening ceremony, that was just extraordinary and like told a very, very clear story without words, but was really about spectacle in terms of size. So I think a lot about that.
Yeah, I think what we need is a big new mega musical in Vegas, because it seems like Vegas is the arena for those kind of the marriage of, you know, musical storytelling with crazy budget scale staging that you can't or don't really want to accomplish in a Broadway theater. What I'm really saying is bring back Starlight Express. That's what I'm really saying.
Bring Phantom back.
Both.
Yeah, I love Starlight Express, but
at the same time,
I'm kind of accepting that there's probably not really going to be another American.
You could just go to Germany and watch it there. It'll be fun.
Yeah, I'll go all the way to Germany and watch it in German. They love it there.
Yeah,
but
with the roller rink.
I don't know if there's going to be any more interest in America. That's too bad. Dang. R.I.P.
Anyway, thank you so much, Sammy, for being here with us.
Yeah, it was of course. Awesome.
Thank you so much for
talking with
me.
You. Do you have anything you want to promote right now? How much longer is Evita?
Evita runs until July 30th at the ART, so definitely folks could go see that. And then it'll open in DC in early September and run through October. And then I have a concert version of Rent that'll be at the Kennedy Center in late July.
Nice.
That's so exciting. Can you dispel any rumors about Evita going to Broadway?
No.
Of course not. Of course.
Nothing.
We'll leave that for the message boards.
That's right. Sweaty Oracle.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. He has many, or they have many, many, many,
many, blah, many blah, sources.
Blah, yeah. Yes. All right. Well, this was so much fun talking to you. I feel like we learned a lot. Follow us on Instagram at theaterworld_presents. That's where we post all of our stuff. And we will see you next time with a brand new episode. Thank you very much, and goodbye, everyone.
Bye-bye.